All right, welcome to Making the Argument. Before we get started, I have a very important announcement. We have a brand new deal with GoodRanchers.com. That's right. If you go into Good Ranchers and you use promo code Nick and you sign up for one of their subscriptions, you're not only going to get $15 off, but do you remember the old deal where you got 2 pounds of ground beef with each order? Well, we just upped the game. That's right. You can choose top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon now. Every single order you get on that subscription is going to come with free top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon. You get to choose which one if you use promo code Nick. And again, $15 off on top of that. That's a savings of $480 in meat by signing up for one of those subscriptions. Not to mention the fact that if you are looking for a gift for someone that is impossible to shop for, you can go on to goodranchers.com and get one of their brand new gift boxes. Now, this is a limited time only offer. It's part of their overall Black Friday special. So go on to goodranchers.com to get more details. Sign up for promo code Nick in order to get that deal, and let's get on with the show.
Because one thing I've learned is this, in politics and in combat, cowardice is contagious, but so is courage. And if you're willing to be the first person over those ramparts, you will be shocked at how many people will come with you. I'm asking you to come with me. I'm asking you to be a part of the generation that will restore the promise of this country and breathe new life into it.
Hi, this is Nick Freitas, and today on Making the Argument, we're going to be discussing COVID, how it started, where it started, what the response has been like, and how we can do a better job responding to it as we're still in the midst of the pandemic. But what also can we learn from this? Obviously, we can't go back and change the past, but what have we learned, and how do we come up with more efficient responses, both to COVID and to any potential pandemics in the future? If you go back and you look at kind of the earliest days with respect to COVID being, or the world becoming aware of COVID, we've traced back the earliest cases to November of 2019. You started to see it featuring more prominently in early 2020. Originally, it was kind of assumed to be just more of a bad case of the flu. And then more and more information started coming out that was a lot more similar to SARS and that could have far more drastic effects. Now, a lot of it started right in China, and the Chinese Communist government went out of their way to suppress the media, to suppress their scientific community. They put out false information to international organizations, to include the World Health Organization. They destroyed sample testing. For a while there, we were being told that it couldn't pass from human to human, and we've since learned that all of that was false. One of the things that's been so frustrating about that is as we look back and we try to learn from the mistakes that were made, the World Health Organization actually bears a significant amount of the blame on this because they just took the communist Chinese government at their word. So at the same time that the government is repressing the press, repressing their scientific community, they're putting out information to the World Health Organization, and the WHO is just spreading it as if it's gospel truth at this point. And that was going all the way into late January. Another thing that was interesting is the response you saw here in the United States. Obviously, concerns started to intensify in January and February. President Trump issued the travel ban on January 31st. He also issued quarantine orders for anybody coming from a hotspot. So if you were coming from one of those countries where they were witnessing a significant outbreak, he required that you be quarantined. And if you look at the response that Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Mayor Bill de Blasio, you know, even the World Health Organization, if you look at the response to that, they were very, very dismissive. They said that the president was just being transphobic or racist, kind of their favorite claim on everything when the president does something. And they weren't actually looking at the data that was informing the president's decisions at this point. Because I think if we would have viewed what the communist Chinese government was saying a little bit more skeptically, if we would have actually been looking at how the virus was operating and some of the information that was coming out from other parts of the world, the president's response was actually spot on. It was correct. One of the things you have to do in order to try to stop a pandemic from taking place in the first place is don't allow significant amounts of travel from those areas where hotspots have already transpired. But you saw Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Mayor de Blasio, they were all out in public events, no masks, no sort of protective equipment, encouraging people to ignore the president and get out there and have a good time, which most likely significantly contributed to the spread of this virus at its earliest stages. So, as time went on, you saw the president using the power of the federal government in order to get resources to where it needed to be. One of the things that's important to understand about the way that the United States deals with issues like this is because we understand that in most situations, you can't have a one-size-fits-all solution to everything, right? The federal government is responsible for certain things, and then state governments are responsible for other things. So the president offered resources to states, to cities, in order to make sure that we were able to get resources where they needed to combat the pandemic, to combat COVID. Some of those states took the president up on those resources. Others didn't use them very effectively. Personally, I think it's a little bit comical that Mayor Cuomo at this point wants to write a book talking about how he handled the pandemic when if you look at the overall cases of coronavirus, New York is number two in the most amount of cases, and it's number four in the most amount of cases, is number two in the overall death toll. And that's one of the things that we've been looking at a lot from this entire outbreak is the number of cases that you have, but also, how is the medical system responded to it? And you can really see a difference by the way certain governors deployed resources and certain orders they put out. So the more information that we had about COVID when it was responding more like SARS and other similar viruses, we recognized right off the bat, and this is pretty obvious, that those people with any sort of compromised immune systems or other pre-existing conditions, the elderly, they would certainly be the most susceptible. So different states took different approaches to that. Governor Cuomo's approach was to require nursing homes to take COVID patients back into the nursing home, which is probably one of the most ridiculous and absurd things you possibly could have done. Now, the governor tried to blame this on the Trump administration off of a CDC report, but if you actually read the CDC report, it didn't authorize nor did it recommend any such thing like what Governor Cuomo did, right? So, in the meantime, while Cuomo is, you know, filling up his nursing homes with COVID patients, President Trump was deploying field hospitals, hospital ships, because if you remember at the beginning of this, it was about flattening the curve. And I just want to discuss real briefly what that means. So anytime you have a large contagious outbreak, there tends to be an immediate spike, because obviously this is something that people are not prepared for. They might not have been anticipating it. Depending on how asymptomatic certain people can be or what the symptoms of the virus are in the first place, it can sometimes spread before people even know they have it. The more human contact you have, the wider the spread's going to be. The reason why there was so much emphasis on flattening the curve is because whenever you have something that's highly contagious and a lot of human interaction, there is going to be people catching the virus. The question is do you have the medical resources allocated appropriately in order to make sure that you don't overwhelm your medical system? That's what we were trying to do, right? The idea that you're going to be able to grab this virus and put it back in a box or defeat the virus, it's not really how this works. People are going to catch the virus. The question is how do we respond when they do? And so you started to see things right off the bat with medical resources being deployed. You had various recommendations being put out by the federal government, various recommendations put out by state governments. Some state governments decided to go in complete lockdown. Other states decided to do something very differently. You saw the same thing on the international stage as well. And this is interesting because now we can go back and look and see which systems actually responded better to the virus. Now, you saw a spike and then you started to see the numbers flatten a little bit. And if you were talking to any epidemiologist or virologist, what they would have told you and what they were commonly saying was, this is typically how a pandemic works. You see an initial spike, it goes down as people respond to that, they start isolating themselves more, and then at some point they get a little bit more comfortable with their environment, or they just have to go back to work because life doesn't stop because there's a pandemic, and then you see another spike. So the reason why flattening the curve is so important, and one of the things that we should focus the most on, is because that's where you get the most deaths, is when you have a spike and you overwhelm your medical system, and the next thing you know, people can't get the necessary treatment they need to be able to beat the virus. The other thing that's really important to combating this long term is what they call herd immunity. So it's the idea that you have enough people that have developed antibodies, you have enough people that have had vaccinations to where the virus is not able to spread as quickly or harm as many people, or when somebody does get infected, the results are not as drastic. Again, just like the flu, just like other diseases or viruses, right? It's not as if it ever completely goes away. It's just about the society in general develops either the natural antibodies and the natural responses to it, combined with the technological and medical innovation that allows you to effectively live within a new environment in which this virus exists, right? Again, that's not a pessimistic outlook either. It's more about just understanding how these things have worked through time and how we do a better job of responding to it. So one of the things I want to do, you know, kind of a once over the world on, because again, to look at the press, it almost seems like they instantly politicized this and started making it out as if if you belong to one party, everything you said was absurd. If you belong to the other party, nothing you could do was ever wrong. And that's not where we need to be the press to be at in a situation like this. One of the most important parts of a free society is a free and open press that is able to get access to good information and give people that information so they can make informed decisions with respect to how to operate. So some of the things that were done on the federal level under the Trump administration were things like expanding telemedicine. And you can imagine how important this was, because in a environment where people have to isolate and it could potentially be dangerous for them to go into a crowded emergency room or to go into a doctor's office when they need something more routine, or maybe they have various procedures that they need to get answers from their medical professionals, but now they can avoid going into the doctor's office and they can do it from the safety of their home. So expanding telemedicine opportunities was very, very important. Another component to that was actually holding up people getting the care that they needed was the fact that if you did engage in telemedicine, there was a lot of regulations that said you might be able to talk to a doctor in your state, but not in another state. Well, a lot of people that have advanced conditions or a visiting specialist might actually have a doctor out of state, and they should certainly be able to call that doctor and not have to worry about state or federal regulations standing in the way of them doing so. And the president led on that front to make sure that people had access to that care. Another thing that you started to see, and I think this is interesting because this is something I've advocated for a while, was you started to see certificate of public need reform. So what certificate of public need essentially is the government, in conjunction with healthcare providers, gets to decide whether or not a new clinic or a new practice can open up in a particular area. And the way I describe it for everybody is, imagine a Burger King wanted to move into your neighborhood, but before the Burger King can move in, they had to get permission from McDonald's and Wendy's. Well, they probably wouldn't get the permission, right? And that's one of the problems that we have with certificate of public need, is it puts up this additional barrier to healthcare being available in certain areas. And you saw certain states with very strict COPN laws actually had less access for people, especially in some of the rural areas. So you started to see states actually reduce or suspend COPN regulations so that more people could come in and actually provide those services. You saw the same thing with what we call occupational licensure reciprocity. And all that means is that if you have a license, maybe you're a registered nurse, maybe you're a licensed nurse, you're a medical doctor, all right, just because you're a doctor and you can work in one state doesn't mean you can necessarily work in a neighboring state, right? And so suspending or relieving some of those occupational licensing regulations allowed us to take medical personnel and flex them to the areas that needed them the most in order to combat COVID. And those are things that we should continue to do. Another thing President Trump did was he fast-tracked the FDA process for approving a vaccine, right? That doesn't mean that they can just go out and do whatever they want. They still have to follow certain safety measures. But right now, the process for actually creating new vaccines or really new pharmaceuticals of any type is incredibly onerous, restrictive, and expensive. And what that ends up doing is putting a lot of the control in the hands of a couple of powerful companies. By fast-tracking this process, he opened up the resources necessary to be able to find a vaccine quicker so that we can use that in addition to other resources to be able to get back, fully open up the economy, and resume some normalcy within our lives. There was also some practical considerations that he did on the economic and the education front. So for instance, a lot of federal regulations having to do with standardized testing were suspended. I mean, obviously right now with everything parents are going through, with everything families are going through, students and teachers, they don't need to be worrying about passing some arbitrary federalized standardized test. Another thing you saw is tax deferments. When businesses are not allowed to stay open, it's a little bit irresponsible and unreasonable to expect them to pay taxes. So deferring those taxes and forgiving some of those taxes is going to be an important process to make sure that our business community, which has been largely affected by this, and all the people that work for those businesses, which have obviously been affected by this, are able to go forward after we get through COVID and as we're going through COVID, to make sure that they can still operate, because we don't want any business to go out of business because of government regulations or taxes that they couldn't pay during a pandemic. Obviously, this is a very important issue, but One of the things I want to talk about is where do we go from here? What sort of policy should we adopt going forward? Because we're talking about a pandemic right now where we've had tens of millions of people affected worldwide. Yes, it has about a 96% recovery rate, which is positive. Most of that 4% that have died as a result of COVID did have some sort of pre-existing conditions or some sort of a compromised immune system, right? But we should be fighting as hard as we can to protect everyone from this in the best way possible. We also need to look at all the other effects as a result of COVID. At the same time that millions of people have been infected, over 265 million people were facing the threat of famine as a result of the shutdown of the economy. We've seen 100 people move into extreme poverty worldwide as a result. And so we have to deal with these economic concerns at the same time that we're dealing with the healthcare concerns, all right? Both things can be true. You can take the healthcare and COVID seriously at the same time that you're also taking the economy seriously, because the reason why we want to save people's lives is because we want them to be able to continue to live their life, to be able to work, to be able to create, to be able to produce the products and services, to include the medical products and services that we all need in order to be able to get through this. So now that we know what we do, where do we move on from this? What should be our plan going forward? Well, there's three general areas that I think the federal government needs to focus on in order to do a better job dealing with COVID as we currently find it, but also to prepare for any sort of pandemic that could take place in the future. The first one is deploying of federal resources where they're needed most in order to make sure that people are getting the care they want. Again, when you have a contagious virus out there, it is highly probable that people are going to catch it. It's more of a question of how do we flatten the curve, make sure that we don't overwhelm our medical resources. One of the ways that the federal government can assist with that is deploying the resources that it has available, whether it be through the CDC, whether it be through the military, as we do have a huge medical apparatus within the United States military. That can be hospital ships, that can be trained professionals and medics. It can be the ability of our National Guard to set up field hospitals. And you saw the president do a lot of that during this pandemic. I think one of the things that we've learned is how can we do that more effectively and efficiently? We sent a lot of field hospitals up and a lot of them went relatively unused. Now, again, I think all of us are willing to say that it's better to have it and not need it than it is to need it and not have it. So making sure that we had that approach and we were ready to give local healthcare systems the support they needed for any sort of overflow was very important. And I think we actually did an effective job right there. I don't think anyone is really complaining that we weren't able to effectively flatten the curve or that our medical system was so overwhelmed that we were having to turn people away. Right? The second thing that we need to do is look at our healthcare system as a whole right now and where were some of the problems. Well, lo and behold, some of the biggest problems that we found within our healthcare system had to do with federal regulations, whether it was COPN laws, whether it was restrictive licensure laws, whether it was restrictions against telemedicine. So we've now identified that some of these things were problems. Some of these things actually stood in the way of people being able to get the medical attention that they needed. So how do we fix that part with respect to access? One, let's look at repealing COPN laws. We need to get rid of those barriers which stand in the way of healthcare professionals being able to come in and set up the medical infrastructure that we need in the areas that need it the most. Again, the government should not be deciding where hospitals and clinics go. That should be determined based off of consumer demand, patient demand. Those are the people we want deciding where those medical resources are effectively allocated. The second part with that has to do with the occupational licensing concerns. Yes, we all want to make sure that medical professionals are well-trained, right? But when we have so many barriers that a well-trained nurse or doctor living in one state can't go to another state and provide services to people that desperately need it, that's absurd. So we need to start looking at greater licensure reciprocity, greater compact law among the several states so that trained professionals can be able to get in there and provide people access to care. Telemedicine. We need to make permanent what we've done with respect to telemedicine. You're starting to see more states adopt this as well. So some of that had to do with removing the occupational licensing barriers among states so that if you did engage in telemedicine and you had to talk to a doctor out of state, you didn't have to worry or the doctor didn't have to worry about running afoul of a litany of laws at the state and federal level. Those are all good things. Let's make sure that we solidify that in law so that going forward, we have a much more flexible and adaptable accountable healthcare system. On the economic front, we need to make sure that we are not engaging in a complete shutdown of the economy. And we need to do this for a couple of reasons. Unfortunately, there was a lot of rhetoric going around that where if you brought up economic concerns associated with COVID, people acted like you didn't care about the healthcare crisis. No, you can care about both. In fact, caring about the economic consequences of the response directly relays into how we respond to COVID. Because if people are getting desperate, if they're losing their jobs, if they can't create the medical devices and the medical services and commodities that we need to get through this, that is a real problem. We also don't want something like what Joe Biden has suggested, where he'd be willing to shut down the entire economy. We have clearly seen, whether it's in places like Taiwan, Sweden, or even states within the United States, that draconian shutdowns don't necessarily reduce the amount of people that are infected by COVID or die of COVID, right? And so we need to make sure that we have a balanced approach where we allow the economy to operate in a safe and responsible manner. And part of that has to do with putting out good information. And there's one other component to this that there isn't a legislative solution for, but I still think it needs to be said. The press have failed us when it comes to COVID. The press have become so obsessed with their political objectives that they have forgotten that they play a critical role in time of a crisis by being able to put out quality, accurate information to people so that individuals can make informed decisions about how they go about their lives, how they seek out healthcare, how they educate their children, how they operate their business or go to work. The press really could have come alongside and assisted with this, and instead they got very, very partisan. I don't expect the press to not ask hard-hitting questions. They should be doing that, especially in a crisis. But can we at least have some fair and objective reporting so that we can all make better decisions, both as policymakers and as individual citizens? So if you have any questions on COVID or our overall response, please feel free to once again contact our website. We also do a Facebook Live Town Hall every Tuesday. And I love to answer the questions on how we can actually come up with better solutions to confront this. Because ultimately, this is not about just waiting around for the government to solve it, right? We all know that that's impossible. The government has a role to play, but it is one aspect of the larger role that we all play in being able to combat this. And so a lot of your best ideas came not from some government bureaucracy. They came from people working in the private sector, whether it was shifting over production from cars to ventilators or from whiskey to hand sanitizer, whether it was people like the 30-day fund in Virginia that were able to get necessary funds to small businesses in order for them to be able to keep their doors open or keep payroll going at a time where they were forced by their government to shut down. So the objective here is not to reduce the responsibility of government, but rather to demonstrate how when government fills its proper role within a pandemic, the rest of the economy, the rest of society is able to function more effectively to combat it at society and community levels as well. All right, we're going to go ahead and take a question from one of our audience members. This comes from Eric. As a conservative healthcare worker, I am frustrated by the constant talking point from the right on national news channels about failures with discharging COVID patients from hospitals back to nursing homes while providing no suggested solutions. Eric, thank you. This is a great question, and you're right. This is not just about pointing out the flaws and what other people have done. It is about really addressing a complex issue. As you know, people that are in nursing homes, that ends up being one of their primary residences. Sometimes they don't have a family to be able to go back to. So the question is how do we address a situation like that? And I think there's a couple ways to do it. One is that if you do have someone that has an alternative residence and they can go to that where they can still get the care that they need, either through home care services or whatnot, that should probably be the first thing that you do within a pandemic because you don't want them to come back into a highly vulnerable situation where other people can be affected. So it is about if they do have an alternative place that they can go through family where they can get the medical services that they require they need, that should be an alternative. And another alternative has to do with coming up with different sites in which they can be housed at while they're actually negotiating the disease itself. So for instance, if you have medical services that are able to come in, and this is where your National Guard hospitals and other things can be of use here, where additional resources can be provided to where someone can go to another location where they're not infecting people that have not already been infected with the virus, I think that is a viable solution. Now, again, Part of the issue here was, is what do we do in the midst of this when these resources haven't necessarily been identified? I think that some states did do a much better job of navigating and negotiating this, but that's not to say that we can't have improvement everywhere. So I would say it's a three-step process. Step one, if there is an alternative residence where someone can go where they can still get the medical care that they require, because as you know, some people are in nursing homes because they need very intensive 24-hour care. Other people are in nursing homes and they don't require the same level of care. So where appropriate, send them to the alternative residence that they have available with deployed medical resources as necessary. You can get this through various home care services, and that's where resources can be deployed there. If you have someone that has to go back and they don't have an alternative residence, the question then becomes, how do we allocate existing resources that we have so that people can go to an environment where they can continue to get that intensive care, but they're not running the risk of infecting people who have not already been exposed to the virus? This is the place where I do think the military and other resources can come in and provide additional assistance, whether it has to do with the National Guard coming in and making facilities available, whether it has to do with other federal resources being available. Again, it's not to say it's a perfect solution, but it would be the second step, I would say, on the alternatives that we have. Now, the last alternative is someone going back into an environment where there's just no other place for them to go at this point. And I think what we have to do is have very, very good isolation protocols. So for instance, if we are dealing with a pandemic, that could be isolating certain people in a portion of the facility where they cannot have interaction anywhere else. I know that some nursing homes were trying very hard to do this, and that's why it should be an absolute last resort. But ultimately, we have to ensure that when we have healthy people in an environment with compromised immune systems, we're not reintroducing people back into that same environment. So I think step one, anybody that does have an alternative place that they can go, they should go. And by the way, that's not just for people that have been infected. That's also for people that have not been infected. There are several people that might have been able to go to an alternative residence with family, gotten health care provided for them at home in a temporary situation until it was safe to be able to come back to the nursing home. I think that has to be a viable option. What that does is it actually opens up space within the nursing home environment where you have fewer people that are exposed. Again, step two is that when you don't have that, there has to be alternative resources available either through within your medical system, or you can flex those resources down from the federal level in order to make sure that once again, you're minimizing the exposure to people that have not been affected. The final has to do with very, very strict isolation orders happening within the home themselves, whether that's isolating a particular wing. And again, I know that's easier said than done, because when someone is living in a nursing home, that room is theirs. It's not as if they're just in a hospital bed, that is their room. But if we're talking about stopping a pandemic, those are some of the more stricter measures that might need to take place in order to ensure the isolation of those patients which are infected in order to prevent spread. So I hope that answers your question, but honestly, I would love to get your feedback on this. If you wouldn't mind emailing us with potential suggestions that you would have, I would love to hear them and incorporate them into policy, because ultimately one of the most frustrating things about government is a never-ending stream of elected officials that think that they always know best, right? I'm certainly not one of those people. I like to hear from the people that are not just the so-called experts. I like to hear from the experts that are also working on the front lines of these issues and can offer positive solutions on how we do it better. So once again, thank you very much, Eric, for your question. Well, I want to thank everyone for joining us for our COVID podcast today. Obviously, this is an incredibly difficult situation. I want everyone to know who's been affected by this. Everyone's been affected in some way, but those of you who have lost loved ones, please know that I take this issue very, very seriously. And this is something where the government does have a legitimate role to play, and it's an area where we should be focusing our attention. There are so many things that the government tries to do that it was never intended to do, that it's not that good at doing. But responding to a pandemic is a legitimate function of government. And I want to make sure that we're allocating the necessary resources, that we're learning the proper lessons, and that we're doing a better job both for COVID right now, but also being prepared for pandemics in the future. Once again, if you have any questions about where I stand on this or other issues, you can always go to Making the Argument on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also go to our website at nick4va.com, where we actually have a list of the schedule. You can look ahead, see what episodes you might want to tune in for, or ask questions, or share with your friends on. Once again, thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, again, one of the best ways you can do it is by heading over to goodranchers.com with promo code Nick. You're going to get $15 off. You sign up for one of those subscriptions and you're going to get up to $480 of free meat with that subscription. You get to pick top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, bacon. It is all up to you. Plus, if you're looking for gifts to get for the people that are impossible to shop for, goodranchers.com also has gift boxes. You need to act quick. This is part of their overall Black Friday special. So head on over to goodranchers.com, use promo code Nick, and once again, thank you for listening.